History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold. That's what we've learned, as long as some of us are willing to take a little initiative and ask a few questions, and then be patient enough to take the time to listen as long-buried memories start to filter back to the surface. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in the process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. 77 years ago this weekend, a small volcanic island in the Pacific, all of 8 square miles, became the scene of one of World War II's most epic battles. We're going to meet one man who was there on Iwo Jima, and before we're done, one who would have been there if he hadn't already been wounded twice. But we'll start out in Sunnyside, Washington, where one of the most impressive veterans memorials I've ever seen takes up an entire city block. I have video of that memorial posted for you at hometownheroesradio.com and on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, where you'll also see some photos of a Marine who just celebrated his 97th birthday. We're going to go back to the early days with Howard Fry, who grew up outside of Ava, Missouri. Where exactly is Ava, Missouri, Howard?
South of Springfield, and that's on the west side of Missouri.
So it's in the Ozarks?
Yeah, now you're getting it. Right.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Yeah.
And you're growing up, the youngest boy in a family with 6 kids. What do you remember about those growing up years? Were you pretty busy? What were you doing?
Working. We're working all the time. And I had to work to get to go to school. I had to work for $1 a day or $2 a day, and that's it, getting money to go to school.
I mean, these are the years of the Great Depression, and we've heard a lot of stories about how hard it was. Yeah. How young were you when you had to start working to help the family?
Oh, about 6 years old.
What kind of work can you do as a 6-year-old?
Cutting course sprouts, $1 a day.
You picked rocks?
Yeah, I picked the rocks, loaded them in the wagons and stuff, had horses and mules and cattle.
Could you see or feel the effects of the Depression? Did that make a difference for your family?
I think so. We had more than some of the other people. That's what it's that way. Cattle and milking eggs and stuff like that. Mom's had to take care of the chickens and stuff, and Dad and we took the outside.
Did you have to milk the cows?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah, milk cows one night and one morning.
Does that mean you couldn't play sports in school because you had to be on the farm?
I went to a 2-room school to start. And Dad and his dad gave them land to build a school out. And it was a country school.
So that was your grandfather's land that they built the school on?
Right. And I went through that and started in Ava, a little town there. Yeah, high school up there. Mm-hmm. But we had buses to carry us up there. I had to pay $1 a month to get on the bus to go to school.
So that's why you had to work to earn the money to pay for the bus ride to school?
Right.
So, I mean, I was just looking at your pictures from the Marine Corps. You're the tallest Marine out there. I was just wondering if you ever tried to play basketball or anything.
No. I just didn't want to.
So I've talked to a lot of guys who say they would have liked to play sports, but their family needed them back at home to work on the farm.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I had to work during the summer to get enough money to go to school in the winter, in the fall and spring, milking cows and all that stuff.
Here's a crazy question for you. I know it's a long time ago, but do you remember when you were a boy back home there in Missouri, did you have a dream or an ambition of, hey, someday when I grow up, this is what I want to be or what I'm going to do?
Yeah, pretty well. I had something to build to. That's all I needed. I did. I got out of when I got into the service. Then that was the end of it. I stayed out.
When did you first start thinking about joining the Marines?
Oh, I had a high school education, and I had to get a deferment to go to that school. And that's where I I just could keep it going. Because I got out of school, then I went into the service.
Was there something you had heard about the Marines, or did you know someone who had been in the Marines?
Just the circulation of, there's stuff like that, you know, coming in the mail and stuff.
Seeing Leatherneck magazine and knowing what they were doing?
We had Leatherneck magazine.
Yeah. What do you think your expectations were for joining the Marine Corps?
I don't know, just to get out and get on my own. That's all about it. In the Marine Corps, I was on Guadalcanal, Iwo Jima, and those.
What was more challenging for you, work back home on the farm or boot camp for the Marine Corps?
I would say both of them about even. Right. Mostly, I had to work at home continuously. And I don't know. I enjoyed getting into the service.
And I don't think I've met a Marine yet who didn't say, once a Marine, always a Marine. And they tell me that it's not just a uniform, it's a mindset and a way of life. How did they indoctrinate you into that? What did they do?
I just don't know. You just follow the commands and everything. It just falls on you. I went to San Diego, Pat Pendleton.
What kinds of things did they have you do?
Everything. We trained on our fishery, yeah. And we was out foreign a lot, quite a bit, to get your positions located, like drop in on the sites. I was good in math, so they put me on the sites mostly. So there's more than one, because when we go in battle, you've got to have two or three behind you. You get knocked off, and the other guy come in. Yeah, I just jumped off a little bit, so I'm into the beach. I was afraid I couldn't make it, but I did.
You hadn't had a lot of practice swimming like that with a pack on your back?
Yeah, quite a little bit. But I was a little, this was after night. Boy.
And right here, you've got an M1 Garand sitting on your table here. How good a shot were you with one of those?
Oh, I think I had a sharpshooter, I think.
That's what that pin says that you were wearing on your Marine Corps uniform, says sharpshooter. Yeah. Is that because you got some practice growing up in Missouri? Were you shooting animals?
Well, it helped, because I could handle a rifle, and a lot of guys, they just couldn't handle it.
What did you shoot at back home in Missouri?
Whatever coming up in front of you. No, squirrels and rabbits and pheasants and all that stuff. See, I went in when I was 18. By the time I got through school, I was 18.
Yeah, I've heard a few stories about guys who would shoot raccoons or rabbits or possums and get money for them, right?
Yeah, I have had that. Did that. About a dollar, if you're lucky.
How did you feel about the idea of going overseas?
Well, I just went along with it. I knew I had to do it, so I did it.
Was there any thought in your mind that you might not come back?
Oh, probably a little bit, but you had to take care of yourself.
So for a while, you were going to be in an Amtrak unit?
Yeah, I was in that for a while, and quite a bit of stuff. When I went into artillery, then I was shooting 105s. We were shooting 105s then.
So when you were with the Amtraks, what did you have to do with that?
That's just more or less carrying stuff.
So Guam was your first combat experience?
Yeah, it was my first one.
What do you remember about that? This is July 1944 we're talking about.
I knew how to had to get off and go in and get in position.
You were on a 105mm howitzer crew.
Right. At first, when I went over there, I was in, you know, the low class, you call it. And there on the first battle, they went in first because it's experience. Then you went in second or third, whenever they needed you. Gotcha. And that was pretty fast. Right.
Had you ever been shot at before?
Oh, yeah, probably a lot of times, but I didn't know it. Artillery.
And so with those 105s, how many people does it take to man one of those?
You got one is pull a lantern just for it. One to close it, then pull the lanyard. Then you had the guys feeding ammunition to you.
What about aiming it, directing the fire? What do you have to do?
It's all done in somewhere else, telephoned in.
Right, they telephone you guys, a forward observer or something says, this is where we need it. But how do you make sure that your shell is actually going to go where they want it?
Well, that was up to the main guys. We were just working on command.
Right, and you said you were good at math, so how did that help you with that job?
I had instruments in here, and every time you go far, you have to take care of that instruments and get your stuff on target, keep it on target all the time, as good as you can. This is a 105, and I was over here. You see that sight right there?
Yeah.
That's the sight. And that's one that keeps it in position. The people are running down, they got people out front ordering back. And then that information comes to us. And then we start firing if we're able to, or stop firing.
So they radio some coordinates to you?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And what do you have to do on the gun itself to try to hit those coordinates?
Oh, this right here is the gun. This controls here. See this here? This makes it go up and down. This guy's doing this here, and I was on the sights over here. He goes this way, and he goes this way. They just say right 20, two or three, up and down, you know. And I was over here all the time.
What could you see through the sights?
Just enough to get an aim on your target or whatever. Well, you know how that works. Crosshairs, and you have to keep this on till the officer's command comes down for you to change it. Then you change it to what he's asked for.
I don't know if you can answer this question or not in a way that we can all understand, but what does it sound like when that gun goes off?
Just boom. A lot of it, yeah, a lot of it. Especially if you're in a quarter faster you go. Four or five or eight beside of you. They're doing the same thing.
Yeah, so there's a bunch of guns lined up firing as fast as you guys can get those shells off. And do you have any protection for your ears?
Well, you could. You have plugs and you go in. But sometimes you get that plug out and you don't have time to put it back in. I was over here and this guy was loading the ammunition here. Mm-hmm. And the guy back here was handing him the ammunition. So it's just a line coming into your guy.
And when you have a line of artillery like that, the enemy would love to take it out. Did you guys have stuff flying your way?
Well, we were lucky. We never did have too much shrapnel hit us. We just lucky, I guess.
But you do have an injury that you just showed me. You've got a scar.
Yeah. Them's got rims. They got rims there.
Well, I want an explanation on that. What kind of rims we're talking about here, and what happened to this veteran of the 3rd Marine Division? It's break time. 97-year-old Howard Fry of Sunnyside, Washington is our guest today, and we'll be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.